Thanks for tuning in to No Big Deal. In this episode, you are going to learn about how to be a consultative seller by understanding your ICP and their challenges. If you feel like you're an inexperienced seller and that may be your biggest weakness, you can actually turn that into a strength. So you're going to learn from Tom how to leverage that experience to build credibility throughout the deal. And lastly, you're going to learn how to maintain an equal balance in the deal with your stakeholders to help you negotiate throughout.
Let me talk you through the two most emotional, stressful months of my sales career.
It's no big deal to call a CTO and tell I want to talk.
You cannot stand on the sideline and basically wait until the dice rolls itself. It's never going to happen.
I don't know if this is going to be on the record or off the record. It's almost like playing with cards, this job. Like, it's like you get given a hand of cards and like you have to do the best with what you have.
Someone might have been watching down on me.
Me and Jack going into this, when he originally told me exactly the same, like, oh, you know, Jack, I've got this idea, you know, what about this? My first thought was, my God, I don't even care if anyone, like, listens to this, you know. If I take one key takeaway from every recording, I'll be such a better rep.
This is No Big Deal, the sales podcast.
It's No Big Deal, series 3, with me, Jack Nico, and Jack Fox. And we are really excited to welcome Tom White from Klaviyo. Tom has never missed a quota in SaaS. I wish we could all say the same. He was voted Rookie of the Year in 2023. And this year, he sold the global largest deal in his segment's history. So well done. And luckily, we're going to hear about that deal today. Outside of that, he is building Socio Vino, an e-com wine merchant, which he has a lot of experience in before he even ended up in SaaS. And he's qualifying as a sommelier. Thanks for coming on, Tom.
Thanks for having me. What an intro. Pleasure to be here.
Cheers, Tom. Are you qualifying or are you qualified as a sommelier?
I have qualified as a sommelier, yeah. I qualified in 2019 as a sommelier, yeah.
Must have been young.
Yeah, so I basically came out of uni and went straight into the wine trade. So probably about 10 years ago now. And I became fascinated with wine as part of my degree, like when I was studying. And then went into the wine trade and kind of worked in there for most of my career has been in the wine trade. And then through that, did a load of courses on the outside and yes, trained to be a sommelier. I never actually worked as one though, because you know, a sommelier is like a position in a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I did all the qualifications that you need to become a somm, but I never actually worked as one.
And that's actually, funnily enough, Tom, interestingly, I know that's how you ended up joining Klaviyo and in SaaS.
Yeah, so it's sort of, I took a funny route in, like I was in B2B wine sales, wholesaling, importing and selling, and then built an e-com brand alongside of it and used Klaviyo to grow the business. And then that sort of did its thing and it was amazing for a couple of years and we grew it and it was brilliant. And then it kind of hit a bit of a point where we needed to pivot again and we needed some reinvestment and the guys I was in business with kind of lost interest. At that point, I was like, maybe I'm kind of interested in this tech world, like e-com and SaaS and stuff. And then it's quite hard to go into SaaS, as you guys probably know, like especially when I didn't want to start at the bottom. So needed to think about ways that I, where places that I had a bit of an edge or tech that I'd used, industries that I was familiar with, and got a warm intro to someone quite senior at Klaviyo who liked my experience and kind of was open to putting me through the process. And that's sort of how I got the eventual job in the end. So yeah,
oh, yeah. It was kind of my route in. Always people would, well, not always, but regularly people are like, how do I get a job in SaaS? Like I got a friend who works in the travel industry. He's a travel agent basically. He's like, how do I get, I've been told I need to get a job in tech. I was like, go and find a travel tech brand.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, you know more about the customer base than probably the people selling travel tech at the moment. That's way more critical. He's like, I don't know anything about tech. I'm like, trust me, mate. You don't need to.
100%. And that was the advice I got was like, think about tech that you've either used or you've been a customer of, or you understand the buying process for, so that when you interview or when you're chatting to the managers, like they understand that you have value to add to their team, despite the fact that you don't have like the direct SaaS experience. So yeah, 100%. Like that's, I would agree with that advice.
And maybe, hang on, it's really easy for me and Jack to say this because we both worked at Sales Loft. Like we sold sales to salespeople. It's really easy for us to do that. Obviously, yeah. Outside of that space, unless you're a developer building a development tool or a security engineer selling InfoSec software, it's not that straightforward. So can you tell us a little bit about what you did with Klaviyo and how Klaviyo helped the previous business and how that helped you transition?
You mean like how I use Klaviyo in my previous business? So Klaviyo, if anybody's not familiar with the tool, it's like customer data platform and kind of marketing tool. So it helps you understand your customers better, like what they're doing on your site, how they're browsing, how they're shopping, like the trends, and then helps you communicate with them like off the back of that through like email and SMS and other kind of mediums. So I was building this wine store and I understood that I had some different kind of customer groups, like really experienced buyers, really novice buyers, people that were like, you know, buying expensive bottles for special occasions. And I needed something that was going to help me understand that better and then build a strategy that allowed me to communicate with these people differently in different customer groups. So, and when I was able to do that through Klaviyo, we were able to build a strategy that made sense and we were pushing people down different customer journeys and giving them information that was relevant, it really helped propel the growth of the business. And like now when moved into Klaviyo, like that is exactly how we often sell it to brands. Like that, the way I used it is exactly the value add that brands are looking for. So yeah, joining Klaviyo meant that I was able to, I'm not just like attempting to put myself in the shoes of the buyer. I have actually been in their shoes, you know?
Attempting to put myself in the shoes of my buyer on a daily basis. And they're like, okay, you have no idea what you're talking about. So I know exactly what you mean. Trying to put that on is fucking hard.
Yeah. And I think the more you do it, I mean, you guys have been doing this job for a long time. So I think the better you get at it, the more like flexible, or you become a bit of a chameleon, you know, you become really good at putting yourself in people's shoes. But definitely when I started, and so like going back to people that are trying to get into the industry, like that's why you need to go in somewhere that you've got an edge or that you understand it, because otherwise you're not, it's going to be so hard for you to put yourself in the shoes of like a cybersecurity manager when you've worked in travel, you know? So like, why would you apply for a cybersecurity company? So yeah. I think it all, like it, when you weave together your narrative, I think it makes sense, that kind of thing. Yeah.
And do you tell that? I'm assuming you tell that story.
Yeah, I do sometimes. Yeah. I don't always do it. I don't like to lean on it too much because I feel like, you know, I want to be able to sell the tool without relying on that the whole time. But yeah, sometimes when it's relevant, I'll bring it up. Yeah.
How did you specifically leverage that credibility in your favor when you got to speak to this prospect and customer?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the other day I had the same thing crop up and I didn't know whether to tell them.
Yeah,
I was like, do I tell you that I sold your biggest competitor already?
So yeah, I think something that we noticed from this specific industry in which like this the big deal happened, and there's been a bunch of like quite large deals at Klaviyo in this kind of space, we understood quite quickly, it's sort of the nature of the game that they're in, that they care a lot about what their competitors are using. You know, sometimes you drop a name in some industries and they're like, yeah, whatever, you know, we don't care what they're doing because we're better than them anyway. In this specific vertical, we became conscious of the fact that they do care about it. And so like it's quite key in the outbound strategy. It's very early on in the discovery conversation. The logos are definitely in a slide in, you know, in the deck, because we learned that that is what they care about. But I think on top of that, you ask like, how does that build credibility or how do we use it in the deal? I think asking them questions that you don't think they're going to have the answers to, because their competitors only learnt those answers through working with you in your deal. So like, if you ask them something that stumps them a little bit and then they're like, oh God, I haven't actually thought about that. Like maybe this guy does know a bit more than me, or maybe this team is going to be able to add value for me, because you're only able to ask that question if you've actually been through it with other people. So I think that's probably one of the things that we were doing, was thinking about the slightly more complicated use cases that have value to them and getting them to tell you that they don't know how to do that. And then they're like, oh shit, I don't know how to do that.
Have you got an example of the type of question?
Well, so for us, we talk a lot about customer acquisition versus retention, right? So what's their reliance on new customers versus returning customers? And that would be quite a top level question. But if you dive into that a bit deeper and you talk about their spend on acquisition versus their customer lifetime value, you know, and then you dive into that a bit further, you ask them like, you know, if your cost per acquisition went up, how would that impact your margins on, you know, going into that, those sort of like deeper questions around their like business strategy. I think they're challenging questions. And I think you're getting into a really, that intelligent discussion around those, they're like, okay, these people have credibility. They actually know what we're talking about here.
Yeah. And the result is probably, I was going to say the result is probably, they're like, shit, we should know this. Yeah. And you go, by the way, we tell companies this.
Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly right. And if they can't answer you, you know, if they haven't got the numbers to hand or they don't have a complete handle on the things that, you know, you're asking them, then yeah, you tell them that you're actually going to be able to give them that to them on a plate or help them improve those. Or what are you going to do if things change and you lose control of this metric? Then, you know, those are the kinds of things that I learned through selling to other brands in the space, so that when you could like roll that into this one, and then it kind of worked in this case.
I want to put a pin in that quickly, because I think that comes down to like credibility, building a sense of like consultative, like you said, a bit of equal business stature. And we're going to come on to that in a minute, but just going back to the beginning of the deal. And also, like, me and Jack are big advocates for what big deals do for people, not necessarily in terms of like what you get paid, but what it does for your career, your reputation, your self-confidence, your belief, all the rest of it. So I guess both of us are just interested to know what this deal did, like, in that respect for you.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of like my attainment and quota, it was like a 700% quota attainment, which is like,
What? The quota?
We have monthly quotas at Klaviyo. So it was 700% of my monthly. I think it was like a 400% quota or something. In that sense, like, that was quite big. And one of my colleagues said was that, which I think is like, is it's basically completely reframed what a big deal is for our segment at Klaviyo, because it's like 4x the next biggest deal. So he said something like it's blown open the segment. And I think it's just like changed the way that people in our segment like think about a big deal, or given them more confidence to go after these, like, what we would consider to be too bigger companies, or, you know, we're not going to be able to sell to them, we don't have the sales acumen, we don't have the whatever it is. But actually, like, you know, it's kind of opened the realms of possibility a little bit in terms of like that and our segment.
It also like about this a lot as well.
The next person's like, oh my god, it's possible.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I adamantly didn't think that was possible, and now I do.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like a different anchor, right? So previously your big deal was anchored at X, but now it's at Y. So everybody you start thinking differently. You don't get so nervous in the call of a deal that used to be a big deal, because actually it's not a big deal anymore. So you start closing more of those deals that were previously big that they're not. You know, nowadays, people are closing deals that would have previously been considered big without even really, like, you know, it's really kind of reframed that. So yeah, I think that that's certainly something which more wider than just me, I think it's changed for us in the team. Yeah.
And for you personally, like, I'm assuming coming into the industry, having had a successful career previously prior and changing direction, I can only imagine it was validating, very validating.
Yeah. Yeah. I think very much so. And it definitely like gives you a bit of a boost. It like solidifies, you know, what I wanted to move, because I wanted to be pushed and challenged and like work somewhere really dynamic that where like growth and, you know, training and like learning and improving is at the center. And like, you know, having a team around you that's really pushing you to like break through these targets and so on has been really great. I think it's definitely, but it's like, I've just been promoted. So like that is another, like, it definitely contributed towards that. I mean, it's done a lot for me personally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to see Tom and his team meetings after his promotion being like, oh, you guys, small deals here.
Exactly.
There's been a little bit of like, oh yeah, this used to be a big deal here. It's not anymore, you know. But yeah.
I love it as well. Like, the first time we spoke, Tom, it was like the end of the quarter, you're miles over target, it was your birthday, you're on your way to Glastonbury.
Yeah.
Like those moments when the fucking stars align.
Yeah.
And you're like, yes, I just love the end of Q2.
Weeks like that don't come around very often.
No, they don't, man. Same with you out there. Remember, while you're hitting the phones today, like there is an oasis at the end of the desert somewhere, and it is called Glastonbury at the end of Q2.
At the end of Q2, what's the only shame is that our accelerators run quarterly, so like that you know amazing period has has ended, so we're back at square.
Yeah, I've lobbied for that to change on a number of occasions. Every business I've been at, no one's ever listened.
Yeah, annual accelerators would be nice.
When you have that in your early career as well, like, you're just so confident going into every opportunity. You just like, it's so weird when, you know, in sales, the lows can be so low. And like, if you're not hitting target, well, Tom, you've not experienced this before, but when you like aren't hitting target, you go into these like opportunities, like just nervous. Your questions aren't that good. You're like, your next steps are pretty shit. And you can be the same seller, and in 3 months' time, you're walking into opportunities just like flawlessly.
It's so true. And I think what's been really cool about this deal and like the transparency with which like we ran it and like have since talked about it and, you know, decomposed it at work, and like, is that hopefully that sense of like confidence isn't just going to be with me. It's going to be with the people in my team, because it's like, have this confidence to do this, because actually it's possible. It's not, you know, we should be going into these deals like, you know, confident and happy that they have a good chance of closing.
This instance as well, often when someone closes a big deal, the reflection is very internal. Whereas if you do something that's like quite monumental like this, the repercussions are actually quite external towards the business as well. Like we go on about it a lot, but Jack did this a few years ago when we were working together. First person to close a deal over six figures in our department. And I remember, and it was like, at the time, it made me so confident. So like the impact of what you can do with that, like change of behavior, is so interesting how that can not just give you confidence, but you just won't realize that externally with us, the rest of the team, which is amazing. Anyway, not to labor this point too much, we also want to hear about, you mentioned there about a little bit about how you ran the deal. And I guess I'm interested to know, did you run it in the same way you'd run typical other deals? Did you stick to the guns, or what kind of different exceptions did you make early on in the deal?
There were a couple of things that fundamentally ran it in a kind of similar way to how I would have run another deal that was like a quarter of the size. The fundamentals, I think, were the same. I think what was different here was that when I became cognizant of the fact it was going to be really big, and when I had to think about like putting it into our CRM at the value that it truly was, knowing that like it was going to blast through the threshold of like what meant that the global VP of sales was going to have eyes on it. I was considering like undervaluing the size of the opportunity and like keeping it under wraps a bit and just trying to run it myself, because I was scared that someone was going to take it off me. It was going to get like qualified out of my segment, or, you know, I was going to have to do an op split with somebody in a more, you know, bigger team or whatever. And I was really considering doing that. I told my manager in like confidence, I was like, look, this is happening, but what should I do? And we thought about it for a little bit, because my manager similarly was like, oh yeah, what should we do here? But ultimately we decided to be truthful about its value from the get-go. And what that meant was that there was a team. We built a team around like internally of different stakeholders across different teams to like brainstorm and just maximize the chances of it winning. And I think the way it was put to me afterwards was that like, look, if you lose this deal on your own and you didn't tell people the true value of the sale, like that is going to be a black mark against your name. That is like, you know, really bad practice, and think about all of the possibilities that could have come from having additional people. Whereas if we involve all of the team, we get somebody from, you know, the tech team, the onboarding team, the customer success team, we get directors involved, we get buy-in from multiple different stakeholders, and then we lose as a team, then we've lost it as a team and we've given it everything we could. And that was definitely like a reframe for me. I'm sure you guys have had similar experiences, but like, it was definitely the biggest team I've ever had around me on a deal. And even though it was really me running the conversations, and very much like my steer was important in the shape of the conversations, having the team around me to like talk about things and debate how we should move forward, I think was huge value. And it was something that I was not totally sure of going into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think sometimes even when you do have the team around you, it's still your fault when you lose it. We're the project managers of the opportunity. But I think like it's actually something that I talked about with Jack, and we would learn like in our experience. You know, it's funny being like hearing you say that, being nervous, and me and Jack were like, we'd probably be in your position like in our first year or 2 years of SaaS. And now it would be like, I've got a massive deal. Like, let's right, start a Slack group. Everyone's getting involved. Like, I want all eyes on this. Like, how are we brainstorming?
Do you think maybe it is a function of being new and being like, keep my class close to my chest? Yeah, because I can imagine. And also, it's the first like really, really large opportunity I've worked on in SaaS. So I guess maybe that is a function of me being new to it and not like appreciating how it works.
I think also your mindset reframes after it happens the first time and you got loads of help from people and you recognize that certain parts of the deal wouldn't have been won without, say, for example, support from the implementations lead or whatever. It makes you realize next time around when a deal comes in and you see a big deal, you're like, yes, I've been waiting for a fucking big deal for ages. Where the fuck are all those people again? I need them again. The first time it happened to me, our old boss, Marcus, I won't do his Australian accent, but I remember I had gone through like 6 weeks of calls with this customer, me and the BDR. It was going to be one of our big deals. It was just me and the BDR. And I had never told anyone else because I just didn't know that I needed to get other people on the call. And then the next call, I got on the call with him. He was like, Foxy, I've just been in the CRM, mate. What the fuck are you doing sitting in your fucking living room trying to close this fucking thing on your own? I was in my living room as well. You can see like all the shit behind me when I'm like demoing to the CROs. And he's like, you never demo them again. I was like, okay. He's like, I've probably got solutions engineers. I was like, what's that?
Yeah. It's so true. And like, I would massively advocate it. Like the next time it comes around, I'll be so quick, like you say, to jump on. And if any of my colleagues are like asking me for advice on a deal, I'd be like, go ask that person, get them involved, start a Slack channel. Like, 100%. Yeah.
I think as well, this is something I talked about, Jack, and for any listeners, something that I've started to do on my deals, if I know they're particularly large, definitely above our average order value, I've been bringing my RVP on to the first or second call to introduce himself in that first 10-minute slot as a bit of exec. Like, hey, you know, Jack talked about this. You're like one of our, you're a customer we'd love to work with. We work with credibility, you know, we work with other customers. I want to put a face to the name because I think a lot of people, when they use that exec chess move, use it too late in the deal where it's like, oh, it's really competitive. I need my VP or CRO to send a draft on behalf to the customer, like get that exec alignment in earlier rather than later.
Yes. I think sometimes that is definitely the right way to do it. I think the way that we framed this deal, and I know this is a point that we wanted to touch on, was that like I was quite keen for this guy, for this prospect and this brand, not to know that they were a really big deal for us because I didn't want them to be able to like really push us hard on price or like, you know, really move the goalposts and what we could offer, because I knew I didn't have a lot of wiggle room in terms of like the proposal. And so whilst we did get exec buy-in right at the very end of the deal, I was conscious that if I did that too early, and I'm not saying that this shouldn't, I don't want to advocate for this being the way that, you know, the whole time, but I was conscious that if I involved my director or even the VP early on in the deal, he would know that he was a big deal for us and therefore put the screws on a little bit in terms of like what we were offering him. And so we did do it. And we played the card right at the end. We had a dinner going on and we invited him to the dinner and our VP of sales were there and it was a lovely touch. But
fucking beautiful nuance of saying.
Yeah, isn't it?
The science of it, which is just like so awesome. And you have your chess pieces in front of you and you're like, fucking bishop straight.
You know what couldn't have been better was like who he sat next to at dinner, right? It was just another customer of ours who'd been a customer for years. And he was this like Geordie, former reality TV star who started an online brand. And he sat next to my prospect, who is a totally different type of person, like completely different, like walk of life. And they started talking about customer acquisition and retention and like how they built their businesses. And my prospect came away from the dinner and he called me the next morning. He was like, I had this brilliant conversation with this guy at dinner last night. He was singing your guys' praises. Like, it, you know, we've got really similar views on business. And it like, it couldn't have been, it was such luck that that happened, that it just was like the final cherry on. I was like, he's buying.
You know? Serendipity, man. I love it. In these deals, there's always a stroke of luck. Like, there's always a VAR call. Yeah, fucking penalty, and you don't really deserve one.
park the luck, because I think it's something that we could get into at the end. One thing I wanted to come back to was, you know, the point you were saying, like, you really needed in this scenario to maintain an equal structure in the deal and not let the main point of contact, or like who eventually became your champion, know how much the balance given that the size of the deal was so large for your segment, was actually in their favor.
Yeah.
Talk to us about how you managed that and the tactical things you did to try and keep that balance in check.
I didn't pander to all of their requests at the moment that they asked them. So he wanted more information on the technical integration, or he wanted information on like implementation timelines, or he wanted, you know, calls to discuss things. And whilst I was always as helpful as I needed to be, I never like dropped everything and got back to him straight away. Or I never like, you know, responded to an email within half an hour. And I never like got on a call a couple of times, you know, I rearranged calls late. And I'm not saying that this should always be done, because like, obviously we want to be really helpful. And like, but I did, like, this was part of the deal, right? This, I'd cottoned onto it from the beginning. And so I did bake it into like how we sold. And there was a little bit of like, kind of like when you're dating, you know, when you're dating early on and you sort of don't want to like,
throw your cards out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know that we do subconsciously do this in a lot of deals anyway, but for this, it was just a bit more overt. And I think my colleagues were like, I cannot believe you're doing this to a deal of this size. And I was like, I'm doing it precisely because it's a deal of this size. Like, and, you know, because I needed that to be in play so that when we came to negotiations at the end of the deal, he didn't think he had the ability to be like, I know this is going to be like game changing for Klaviyo, for you, for the segment or whatever. I want, you know, 50% off or whatever it was.
Yeah. Interestingly, it's a really cheesy phrase in sales, but that people say you should always be closing. But I firmly believe that the closing starts at the beginning, and it's behavior like that, where you're like, when we get to the end of this, I have been closing you for 3 months. And trust me, I've been working on making sure that I've got equal balance, like respect, credibility. And it's those sorts of things that build it up. It's not just the end when you're like, here's the DocuSign. It's the whole, turning up a bit late to the call, or, you know, being ever so slightly confrontational when you deserve to be.
And I think like what he didn't realize was that I was obviously working harder than I'd ever worked behind the scenes to make sure that everything was lining up. I had absolutely everything like watertight, you know, gold sealed, the rest of it. I just didn't want to present like that to him. I wouldn't say that's always the way to go, but that's what we did in this deal. And we chatted about it a bit as a team, and like, you know, I think it certainly helped. Like you said, we were trying to think like 10 steps ahead so that he thought that things were moving along in his time, but actually like we were trying to get him where we needed to get him.
Yeah. I think so many times you have it, the most common use cases, I think, and I think every single deal that you probably have, you have this scenario, or at least a lot of them, where you want to send a chase email and you're like, one more day.
Yeah.
Sometimes the best thing to do is nothing.
Yeah.
And they'll come back like 80% of the time, they will come back to you a day later or 2 days later because they're busy and they've got other shit going on. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. Like, we're busy too. You know, I've got loads of people that want to buy. I've got tons of people that I'm chatting to on a daily basis, his competitors, you know, other industries. And that was really the impression that I wanted to give, was that like, he was just another one of the deals that I was working on, not like my entire
This is such a good example of holding your nerve. Like, hold your nerve and you will pay off. Tom, tell us, what is your, because there's obviously so many really great headlines on this, what was your favorite memory of the deal?
I mean, when he's buying, he actually bought on the call with me. The deal was closed like on the call with me. He actually like clicked the button and he said buy when he was on the call with me. Meanwhile, my colleagues are following this. We've got a Slack channel, which like tracks every sale that comes through, you know, just so you can keep an eye on like when deals are upgrading or anything like that. And one of my colleagues comes out of his little booth and stands outside the booth and he's like, I'm there on the call and like under my table. I'm like I'm sitting like on my top half. It's like, thank you so much. Like, you know, we're going to get you signed up for onboarding now. Like the next steps of this, but inside I'm like,
oh my God.
Yeah,
you know what? That was a highlight. You know, I miss being in the office closing deals like that, man.
Yeah, that was a highlight. That was a huge highlight. I think there was another moment where we'd like really been leaning on a partner of ours who was working with them on like implementation, and like they're going to be managing some of Klaviyo for the brand. And there was a point when the Klaviyo was new for the agency as well, so there was a bit of selling to the agency as there was to the brand. We had to really get the agency to buy in on the value of Klaviyo. And there was a moment where we'd had meetings with the agency separately to the brand, really getting them to understand the value that they could add by using Klaviyo. And after a few calls with the agency, one of the agents actually said to me, Tom, we've decided that we're not going to take on this work for the brand unless he's using Klaviyo. And at that point I was like, sick, because he was already paying for this agency for other marketing services. Yeah. And I knew that they were part of his growth strategy. He'd already committed to them. So when they said that, I was like, holy shit, this has got a really good chance of closing now. Yeah. And then my manager's like, how did the call go? Like, where are you moving this opportunity to? I'm like, I think I'm going to commit this now. And like, that was quite mad as well.
That's the moment where you know you've got them boxed in.
Yeah.
You're like, I think I've got leverage now. Yeah. I have to do this. That's the moment where you're like, now I'm putting this in the forecast. And that's when everybody wants to know every fucking day. Any updates? You're like, yeah. Trust me, I would tell you if I had one.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And almost like, oh my God, I can't believe it, but I've actually got this guy in the corner now. Yeah. And like, he's going to buy. I think there was another moment as well earlier on in the deal cycle where like we had a really good, it was like the second or third call, and we had a really, really good discovery call. And he was really like, the prospect gave us loads of numbers and like all of his strategy and where he was hoping to get to and where he was spending, where he was losing money. And that really allowed us to build a compelling business case. And I think after that call, when I was like, oh wow, we've actually really got a case here, because he needs us if he wants to do this. And like, so that call was really pivotal as well, I think. Just being able to, I don't know if we were asking the right questions, or the prospect, we gained a bit of his trust, so he was willing to share all of these numbers with us. Because sometimes you ask these questions and people don't know the answers, or they don't give you the answers, or they're a bit, because these were like proper business metrics I was trying to get from him. And that was quite pivotal as well, I think.
I think often that's what makes or breaks the deal's momentum. When they're willing to share that, they know what they're trying to measure. You know how you can improve it. I think that's where everybody's like, we're speaking the same language.
Yeah.
I think so.
And sometimes, you know, when you first have that chat, they don't want to give it up, or they don't, you're not trustworthy enough, you're not credible enough, you know, you haven't proven yourself enough almost to give them that info, to be given that info.
I've learned that a lot from going like more enterprise at Sales Loft. Like, I could get pretty good, solid business metrics on like call one, selling to like commercial. And now I'm like call three, four, where I've earned enough trust where they give me that stuff.
Yeah,
man, 100%. Well, that kind of led me on to my next question, Tom. Is there any sort of like particular skill of yours, or sort of like particular attribute of yours that you know is quite unique to you that really helps you, not just with this deal, but really helps you in general with selling?
So something I've spent a bit of time thinking about since like doing SaaS sales, I think, and potentially worth sharing, is so much of what I learned from the world of business, like working in a company that, you know, buys and sells and negotiates and like has a, you know, a product, the physical product, very much an old school industry, just like working in business, I think helps me a lot in these conversations with companies now I'm selling to them. Because, and I think this would go to people that are considering like moving into SaaS, or don't underestimate the experience that you've got from elsewhere and how much that might bring to your skill set in the role. Being able to talk to businesses, not asking them questions because I've read that these are the questions that I should be asking, or because I've watched on Gone Calls, this is what other people ask, or because this is what we're taught to ask. I'm asking this because I need to know this in order to understand your business properly, so that I can pitch in or give you some ideas around how we might be able to help. And I think that probably comes with time doing a SaaS sales job, because you're talking to companies all the time, but having, you know, coming into it completely fresh, I was able to lean on that a bit, and I think it served me well. So I would say, yeah, not underestimating experience from outside of the space has definitely done me well. Yeah.
100%. I think like there's not enough people with that sort of like life experience and commercial acumen in software in general. People just get streamlined into it, and then they're like, APIs, user-based pricing, fucking software. It's like, yeah, that shit is important, yeah, but the more important stuff is like how the businesses operate, what if people who spend money care about, like there's an element of like commercial maturity that comes with having exposure to real life events as well. You just can't buy, you can't fast track it either. You have to have lived it.
I think that's true. Yeah. And like how to negotiate, how to position yourself in a deal, how to not oversell yourself too early on. And like all that kind of thing, I think comes from time doing SaaS sales. But I think for people that come into the businesses without that direct experience, there's a lot that you will have learned or could have learned from outside, I think. Yeah.
Do you know what? It's one of the reasons I work where I work now is I wanted so badly to get exposure to businesses and how they operate from a financial perspective, which is what we sell, like a financial planning solution. And the insight it's given me into what CFOs care about, what they measure, what they track, what they talk about, how the business ticks on a daily basis is like second to none. I wouldn't have gotten just a normal AE job, for example. You learn about your customer and your software, but you don't learn that much. Anyway, we should probably wrap up. Jack, is there anything else that we need to cover?
No, I think we pretty much nailed everything that like we wanted to when we were prepping with you, Tom. It's been like a really great chat. So thanks so much for your time.
Mo, my pleasure. Thanks for chatting to me about it. It's been great. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice one, Tom. Thank you, mate. Really appreciate it.